That's right. That's not just right, it's exactly right. I read on Facebook this week, "Our current study through the minor prophets has humbled me and made me realize that when we neglect the prophetic books of the Old Testament, we will most definitely underappreciate our citizenship in the kingdom of God. We will not know truths like this one, for at that time I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech, that all of them may call upon the name of the Lord and serve him with one accord." Zephaniah 3:9. Hashtag minor prophets, major truths. True minor prophets, major truths. True, if we don't read the Old Testament, we don't study it, the prophecies, which are difficult, and you say, what in the world's going on? But you can get out of it that there's something in there and it's talking about us, and if you don't read it, we're missing out on a whole bunch that God has prepared for us. Wes McAdams, don't really know who he is, have some vague idea who he is. He's a preacher somewhere. So he and the congregation there are studying the prophets. That's what we're doing too. It brings me comfort to know that some other Christian somewhere is doing the same thing that we are. At the same time, God says, "I will change the speech of the peoples into a pure speech." Does that reflect me? Because God's going to trying to change both me and those people over there. And I wonder who's winning. I hope we both, all of us, are winning. Okay, so we are in Jeremiah. We're not anywhere Jeremiah. Isaiah 28. Isaiah 28, six woes. We're picking up basically exactly where we left off. We did cover this a little bit. So we're in between the back and forth of I'm going to punish you and I'm going to restore you, because that's what Isaiah is, right? So chapter 28, verse 1. Verse 1 through 4 is Ephraim is just going down, is what I write. Woe to the proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim. Verse 2, the Lord is a strong and mighty agent, like as a storm of hail, a tempest of destruction, like a storm of the mighty overflows waters. He has cast it down to the earth with his hand. The proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim is trodden underfoot. Well, the reason why is because they're depraved. For example, in verse 7, these also reel with wine and stagger from strong drink. The priest and the prophet reel with strong drink. Okay, so if the priest and the prophet are reeling with strong drink, then what's the nation doing? They don't have a clue. They are confused by wine. Well, skip over to verse 9. They are saying, to whom would he teach knowledge? Okay, so here comes this guy Isaiah, and he's telling us something from God. At least he says so. But wait a minute, we're the prophets. We're the priests. Who is he to tell us? To whom would he teach knowledge? And to whom would he interpret the message? Those just weaned from milk? Those just taken from the breast? For, he says, order on order, order on order, line on line, line on line, a little here and a little there. I take that to mean that he is talking to them as though he would talk to a child. And they're saying, wait a minute, we're not children. We're the priests, we're the prophets, we're the ones who know. Who are you to tell us? Okay, so here comes the prophet. And the prophet says whatever he says, and they say, who are you to tell us? Here's a question. There is a certain principle that when people stop listening to the Lord, what does the Lord do? Stop speaking to them. For example, when Paul, he was preaching to the Jews and they said, we don't want this anymore. And he quoted from the Old Testament and said, we're going to the Gentiles. What did he do then? He, yes, symbolic of, I'm not putting up with this. You're not putting up with me, so I'm not putting up with you. The same thing in Luke chapter 10. He sends out the 70, go preach and stay wherever. If somebody will listen to you, stay. But if they don't listen to you, shake your feet off the dust and leave. So here's this principle. Look, if you stop listening to God, he's just going to go away. Verse 11, indeed, he will speak to this people through stammering lips and a foreign tongue. This is a reference to them. You're in Israel right now, but guess what? You're going to go to Babylon, and they're not going to understand you, and you're not going to understand them. The stammering lips, do they stutter? No, that's not the point. But like the word, I don't know if you know this, but the word barbarian comes from the idea that that is what the other, the foreign, if you're a Greek, everybody else sounded like bar, 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 bar to them. In fact, they would call women who they didn't understand from foreign countries doves or little birds, because the women tweeted like birds. Okay? Because you don't tweet, 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 tweet until you understand them, and then, oh, they're making sense here. Well, he's going to send you, he will speak to this people through stammering lips and a foreign tongue. He who said to them, here is rest, give rest to the weary, and here is repose, but they would not listen. So the word of the Lord from them to them will be order on order, line on line, a little here, a little there, that they may go and stumble backward, be broken, snared, and taken captive. So he is going to speak to them. Now, this is talking initially, primarily about you are going to go over there, far over here to Babylon, and that's where you're going to hear a people of stammering lips. Now, do you remember where this is quoted in the New Testament? Anybody? Anybody? Verse 11, he will speak to this people through stammering lips and a foreign tongue. Anybody remember where this is quoted? Or just look in your cross references. Right? And you come to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, which you all remember is a discussion of speaking in tongues. He says, look, guys, be more mature. Don't just chase after these tongues. That's the idea of the context. Verse 20, 1 Corinthians 14, 20. Brethren, do not be children in your thinking, yet be evil, yet in evil be infants, but in your thinking be mature. In the law it is written, by men of strange tongues and by the lips of strangers I will speak to this people, and even so they will not listen to me. And so he quotes from Isaiah what we just read, and he applies it now to Christians speaking in tongues. Two things about this. As a brief side note, did you notice that Isaiah here is referred to as law? What's the law of God? Isaiah. Psalms is also referred to as law, but that's a side note. Okay, so he takes, so God says, look, Ephraim, you're not listening to me, so I'm going to send you over there, and you're going to be in Babylon where they don't speak your language, and you're going to hear bar, 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 stammering lips. Now he quotes this now and applies it to Christians speaking to Jews. Here's a question for you. Who in this room would have applied Isaiah chapter 28 verse 11 to speaking in tongues? I'm guessing nobody. And if you would have, you would not have done it with confidence. It would have been just a guess at best. And I'm guessing that you would not, and I would not have guessed. So, I would not have guessed, and our principle that we are pounding into our heads over and over is, leave the guessing to the inspired authors. Paul was inspired. That's why he can say, Isaiah 28:11 has relevance here. And you say, oh, really? Okay, I guess I believe it because Paul, the inspired author, said it. So leave the guessing to the inspired authors. How does this have application? I received a message, a question this week from one of my dispensationalist friends. My other question is about recent refugee crisis. He's a Hungarian. He speaks English very well. Pretty much I had to insert is there. But that was a mistake on his part. So my other question is about the recent refugee. So in Hungary, they got a whole bunch of Syrians going from Syria to Germany right through our backyard. What do you think? Could it be because of God's prophecy, like in Isaiah 17:3, where the remnants of Syria are mentioned to go into exile? I know that traditional interpretation considers that Isaiah 17 was fulfilled in the past, yet 17:1 has never been fulfilled up to now, as far as I know. That's what he writes me. How do you reply? I'll tell you what I replied. I said, number one, I don't think Isaiah 17:1 has any application to now because no inspired author anywhere even hints at it. Number two, Isaiah 17:1 seems to have been fulfilled when Assyria sacked
Damascus.
Thank you. Right. So I quoted it, I sent it to him, so here are some other people that think the same thing. These are uninspired. These comments that I'm about to send you are uninspired, but the idea is, look, the context is way back then. It could have been fulfilled way back then. The essence of the prophecy is that, look, Damascus is going to be gone. Well, they were gone forever when they are no longer an international force or power. But again, the major point I was trying to get across to this guy is, look, I can't just pick and choose what I want without somebody in the New Testament or somebody else saying it applies to 2016 walking through hungry Syrians. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had a question. Okay. Or a comment. So this is real. I mean, we deal with this in our own study, and we deal with this talking to other people all the time. This week I got this question. Go ahead.
Just an interesting point about, you know, some people think that speaking in tongues is the heavenly language and yada, yada, yada. We hear this, but yet he quotes, Paul quotes in 1 Corinthians 14:21, he quotes this, and in 28:11, he's not talking about a heavenly language. He's talking about real languages. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Another way to say, hey, this
yep.
is not... These are real languages.
Yep.
Just like Spanish, French. Those
right.
languages, not gibberish.
Right. Not bar, 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 bar. That's, which is what they'll do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good point. Thank you. Okay, so back in chapter 28... Verse 14, now he's going to start talking to Judah, or Jerusalem specifically. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, you scoffers, who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. Okay, so he's gone from Ephraim, and now he's pointing his finger right at the Jerusalemites. Right, you have children. Three of them get in trouble. The other one thinks, ha-ha, I didn't get in trouble until you're just taking your time. You got to go through 1, 2, and 3 before you get to 4. That's what he... Therefore... Hear the word of the Lord, our scoffers, who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we have made a pact. The overwhelming scourge will not reach us when it passes by, for we have made falsehood our refuge, and we have concealed ourselves with deception. Okay, what is this covenant with death, with Sheol, the pact? I don't know. Is it an alliance with Egypt? Is it something generally? No, we just have full confidence. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. You know, nothing, the temple, the temple, the temple. Nothing's going to happen here. I don't know what it is, but I know this. They have the truth, yet they believe the falsehood. Now, let me make a prediction. Based on a pattern that we have been seeing frequently. In verse 9, you are guilty of rejecting me. Verse 11, therefore... I'm going to predict that you're going to have suffering. Verse 14 and 15, you are guilty of rejecting me. I wonder what he's going to say next. Verse 16, therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed. And you know this is quoted all over the Gospels and in 1 Peter also. And he's saying, look, this is ultimate judgment. I'm putting it, we know this is talking about Jesus, but right now all they understand is this is judgment. We know it's ultimate. They're going to lose their status as a nation because they have rejected him. I will make justice the measuring line and righteousness the level. Okay, so here comes the standards. There's going to be a house cleaning in Jerusalem. Then hail will sweep away the refuge of lies and... the waters will overflow the secret place. Your covenant with death will be canceled. Your pact with Sheol will not stand. When the overwhelming scourge passes through, then you become its trampling place. As often as it passes through, it will seize you. This is not going to be just one time. And you know from your history, here come the Assyrians. And then after that, here come the Nebuchadnezzarans. And then they come 3 times. And then here comes Persia. And later on, Alexander will come. It's going to happen over and over and over again. Why believe the falsehood when they had heard the truth? The
devil is a master at making it look so easy. They're so enticing.
You were ready for this one. So, verse 15. We have made a covenant with death. Sheol, we have made a pact. The overwhelming scourge will not reach us. For We have made, now you don't, you walk up to them and say, have you made falsehood your covering? They wouldn't say that, but that's a reality, what has happened. Our refuge, and we have concealed ourselves with deception. There it is. So the question is, why believe falsehood when they had heard the test, the truth? Ethan says, because the devil is the master at making it look okay. He is the master. But, and I wholeheartedly agree with everything you just said, but why, when they had the truth, did they believe, did they fall for the devil's trick?
The implications of the truth were unattractive to them?
Unattractive implications of the truth.
It's kind of the opposite side of the coin. I mean, it really isn't all much different from what you said.
No. Right. So I can think of several reasons. One that you stated, that you both are talking about, is in 2 Thessalonians. By the way, why are there so many false religions and so many false denominations out there? Here's your answer. 2 Thessalonians, chapter 2. I'm going to start in verse 9. Those whose coming is in accordance with the activity of Satan, that's what you're talking about, he's tricky. With all power, with signs and false wonders, he's tricky. And with all deception of wickedness for those who perish because they just can't figure it out on their own. Because they did not receive the love of the truth, so to be saved. Why? For this reason, God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they will believe what is false, in order that they may be judged as those who did not believe, but took pleasure in wickedness. This is actually everything that you guys have just said. Yes.
Oh, I think it's interesting. In verse 10, My translation is a little bit different. It says, because they refused to love the truth.
Yeah.
And so be saved.
They refused to love the truth.
That's what boils it down to.
Yeah, and it's more active.
It's like Romans 8:28 says, God works all things together for good to those who love God.
Yeah.
And those who love his appearing.
Yeah.
You know, it takes effort on our part.
Yeah. Yeah, mine is passive. I'm guessing, I don't know, I'll look this up. I'm guessing mine's actually more accurate, but yours has got the point. But the idea is, look, mine says they did not receive the love of the truth. Oh, man, I didn't get it and you did. No. As your version points out, no, you reject, it's very active. Okay. And also Hebrews chapter 4, verse 2, talks about, it was not united by faith. Verse 2. Indeed, we have had the good news preached to us, just as they also. But the word they heard did not profit them because it was not united by faith in those who heard. I just got to turn it on. I turned it off. I think down is the right. Yeah. So here, it's look, I don't love the truth because I want to do what I want to do. And if you don't love the truth and you want to do what you want to do, God will send you a deluding influence. Over here, look, I don't trust what God says to me. What? It is possible, folks. The question is, what about me? Because anybody can go there. Anybody can get there.
John 3:19 is the same.
Which says, yeah.
Here's the judgment, light is coming to the world, men prefer darkness.
Right. Exactly. And I'm convinced that he says that to Nicodemus to say, look, Nicodemus, I know all the people out there. You came to me. But the question is, Nicodemus, what are you going to do? So here's the truth. And then he ends with this weird statement to Nicodemus. Why did he say it? I'm convinced it's, Nicodemus, you know the truth. Now what are you going to do with it? And we know the rest of the story. Nicodemus comes to him, but exactly right. This also applies to the Jews rejecting Jesus. First of all, this passage right here in Isaiah is quoted several times in the New Testament and applied to Jesus. So we know it applies to Jesus. Why did the Jews reject Jesus? Because they didn't love him. They didn't love the truth. They wanted to do what they wanted to do, and they didn't trust him. Isaiah 53:1, Lord, who has believed our report? They heard it. The question wasn't whether or not they actually understood it. No, they didn't want it. Isaiah 53:1 is quoted in Romans 10:16. And the whole point of Romans 10 is in the middle of 9, 10, and 11. What happened to Israel? Why didn't Israel get saved? Well, they didn't hear the message? No, they heard it. Go ahead.
Right in line with what you're saying here about how it applies to the Jews, this section in Isaiah, verse 15 and 16 here, we made a covenant with death. As we were reading this, and I'm not saying that this is prophecy of any specific kind, but it reminded me of the attitude of the Pharisees in Acts 23 when they make a pact not to eat or drink until they killed Paul. This, I mean, what is being the quote that Isaiah is using here to present the attitudes of these people in verse 16 is it's the same attitude. It sounds like it's coming out of their mouths, you know?
Right. Same. Which we'll make a point from this later. You can probably make it in your head right now. If they're the same, well, we'll make some points from that. This passage, verse 16, is quoted. Peter quotes it in 1 Peter chapter 2. And the point is, get this, there is nobody more special than a Christian. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, he begins part of his argument, coming to him as to a living stone. So he's the stone. He's the living stone, which has been rejected by men. Okay, that's based on the passage we're reading. But is choice and precious in the sight of God. Okay, all right. Jesus was killed by men. But in God's eyes, he was choice and precious. Just like him, you also, verse 5, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Okay, if we didn't even read further, we understand he made an application. Jesus is choice and precious in the sight of God, and we're just like that. That sets the stage. Verse 6, for this is contained in Scripture. Now he quotes our passage, and he says, whoever believes in him will not be disappointed. No, you will have everything that God has got going. My father says, when we sit down to dinner at a nice big spread, somebody will say, do you want potatoes? Do you want steak? And my dad always says, I want whatever's coming to me. We understand that. I want it all. We're going to get it all, whatever God's got in mind for us. But for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone and the stone of the stumbling and a rock of offense. For they stumble because they are disobedient to the word, and this is doom. And to this doom they were appointed. But you, so he goes back and forth. There's the people who reject him, and then there's you. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood. Number one, who wants to be a priest? I do. Who wants to be a royal priest? I do. A holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of the darkness into his marvelous light. For you were once not a people, but now you are the people of God. The people of God. Who are God's people? The homosexuals? The transvestites? The people who cross-dress? The people who go into... Is everybody who the government's pushing right now, are they the people of God? No. Christians are. You are the special people. Of course, we want others to become special also. But you have received mercy. And so what, beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lust. So you're important and you're privileged and special to God. But at the same time, there's an obligation on each and every one of us. Comments or questions on what we've talked about here? Yeah.
The fact that in this one instance, people...
May I quote you?
Sure. But, I mean, you think about anybody that the society thinks is, oh, they're privileged, oh, they're special, or they're set apart somehow. Does that absolve them of every responsibility that is... It never does. And nobody thinks that.
Yep.
Except for in this instance.
Okay. So... we are in chapter 28, continuing verse 20. This seems to be the certainty of the coming judgment. The bed is too short on which to stretch out, and the blanket is too small into which you will wrap yourself. Okay, you take a blanket, you cover yourself up to protect yourself from being cold. That's how I interpret this. I don't know for sure, but the point seems to be God is going to come. There's nothing you can do. You're making this protective measure over here, and it isn't going to work. 4, verse 21, the Lord will rise up. He will be stirred up, so on and so forth. It is coming. There's nothing you can do about it. We'll skip down to chapter 29. Unless somebody has something from the previous. Here's the second woe. There are six woes in this section. Here's the second woe. It first begins, woe, O Ariel, O Ariel. The ESV has a footnote, the line of God, or hero, or the altar hearth. The New American Standard Bible has a footnote, Jerusalem, because it says where David once camped. Okay, so it's talking to God's people. We understand that. Add year to year. Observe your feasts on schedule. I will bring distress to Ariel, and she will be a city of lamenting and mourning, and she will be like Ariel to me, and Ariel, which is also another translation, is a threshing floor. I'm going to beat the tar out of her. I will camp against you, encircling you. I will set up siege works against you. I will raise up battle towers against you. I take this to refer to Assyria. Whether or not I'm accurate in that, I don't have to be. I know I get the point. I'm going to judge you. I'm going to beat you up. I think it's Assyria because of what he says in verse 5. Verse 4, you will be brought low. And in the end of verse 4, your speech will whisper from the dust. Who wants to be in that situation? Nobody. That's a situation of your face is in the dirt. Verse 5. I believe verse 5 is hinting at something that will be discussed in length later on, and that is, yes, the people I'm using to judge you, they actually won't be completely successful. But they're going to do a lot of damage. The multitude of your enemies will become like fine dust. And fine dust blows away. I believe that's the idea. And the multitude of the ruthless ones like chaff, which blows away. And it will happen instantly and suddenly. Oh, pay attention to that. Okay. Verse 6, for from the Lord of hosts you will be punished with thunder and earthquake and a loud noise, with whirlwind and tempest and the flame of a consuming fire. And the multitude of all the nations who wage war against Ariel, even all who wage war against her and her stronghold and who distress her, will be like a dream, a vision of the night. It will be as when a hungry man dreams, and behold, he is eating. When he awakes, his hunger is not satisfied. When a thirsty man dreams, and behold, he is drinking. When he awakens, behold, he is faint, and his thirst is not quenched. Okay, thus the multitude of all the nations will be. Either, this is saying, when these nations are beating you up, they will never be satisfied. Or, when you are getting beaten up by these nations, it is going to be a horrible experience for you. Either way, you get the point. Yeah, or both. Right, thank you. Verse 9, be delayed and wait. Blind yourselves and be blind. They become. Okay, so who would want to be in this situation we're describing? Nobody. Why is this happening? Skip down now to verse. No, we'll read verse 9. Be delayed and wait. Blind yourselves and be blind. They become drunk, but not with wine. They stagger, but not with strong drink. 4. The Lord has poured over you a spirit of deep sleep. He has shut your eyes, the prophets, and he has covered your heads, the seers. The entire vision will be to you like the words of a sealed book, which when they give it to one who is literate, saying, please read this, he will say, I cannot, for it is sealed. Then the book will be given to the one who is illiterate, saying, please read this, and he will say, I cannot read. So they're trying to figure out what it is, and they can't, and they can't, and they can't. Now, why this situation? Verse 13. Then the Lord said, because this people draw near to me with their words, and they honor me with their lip service, but they remove their hearts far from me, and their reverence for me consists of tradition learned, and my version says, by rote. Therefore, I will once again deal marvelously with this people, wondrously marvelous. I believe this is the same as chapter 25, 1. 13 through 24, I'm going to destroy the world. Chapter 25, Isaiah says, you are to be praised for your marvelous works. What marvelous works? He judged the world. I believe that's what it's talking about here. I will once again deal marvelously with these people. I'm going to judge you. Okay. 1 through 12 is Israel will be brought low. 13 and 14 includes hypocritical worship. Anybody got any comments about hypocritical worship? I have one or two.
It could never be me.
about my religious service. Do I need to be religious? Thank you. Let's cut to the short. Yes, we have to be. Pure and undefiled religion is this. Now, it says to visit, and that's not something we do as a group, but guess what? Other things we do as a group are our religious service. So yes, we do need to be. But here are the questions. Can I be religious yet not be pleasing to God? Here. Hold on. Where are my notes? Yeah. Here. Can you think of... would you have called Nadab and Abihu religious?
They wore clothes, right?
They wore... Yeah. They were running there with the religious implements. But were they pleasing to God? Not at all. 1 Corinthians 11. The first part of 1 Corinthians 11 is about what? What tradition? The head covering, somebody said. The second part of 1 Corinthians chapter 11 is about what tradition? Were they keeping the Lord's Supper? Were they doing something? Were they doing something in the assembly? Yes. Was it religious? If you'd ask them, are you being religious? What would they have said? Yes. Was it pleasing to God? In this, I do not commend you. Can I perform God's religious ceremonies yet not be pleasing to God? Okay, so we've... Can I perform God's religious ceremonies and yet not be pleasing to God? Can you think of anybody? Anybody? This seems to be chapter 29... Verse 1, add year to year, observe your feasts on schedule. Well, who was supposed to observe feasts? They were. And where's that written? In the law of Moses. Were they doing it? I take it they were. Matthew 23:23. You observe, you tithe, mint to Dylan coming. Were they religious? Yes. Were they doing God's religion? Yes. But they had messed it up. 1 Corinthians 5. Was the man who had his father's wife religious? He was there every Sunday. Those are the kind we like, right? The every Sunday ones. And the every Thursday. I mean, every Thursday and every Sunday. Wow, we got a ringer there. No, not necessarily. This calls for honest introspection. What about me? 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Turn there now. The emphasis being on turn there, not now. Turn there. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, therefore, verse 27, whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup in an unworthy manner, are they being religious? Yes. Is it worthy before God? No. Shall be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. You're taking the Lord's Supper. Well, that's got to be great. You're doing it the wrong way. It's not good at all. But a man must examine himself. Ah. And in so doing, is to eat the bread and drink the cup. For he who eats and drinks judgment to himself, for he does not judge the body rightly. For this reason, many among you are weak and sick, and a number sleep. But if we judged ourselves rightly, we would not be judged. But when we are judged, we are disciplined by the Lord, so that we will not be condemned along with the world. Yeah. Introspection. Not only the way, that they had messed up the way. Their priorities and their motives were also messed up. Your whole life. Look, you don't just come in here and sit down and take a shot and eat some bread and say, hey, that's great. It's got to be a whole lifestyle, praying with holy hands. Go ahead.
I mean, it's the same, almost literally exactly the same. 2 Corinthians 13:5. Examine yourselves to see whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Or do you not realize this about yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you fail to meet the test?
Yeah, I actually go to that passage, always, 1-2, bang, bang, because, it's because they were messing up the Lord's Supper. Yes, that's true, but it's more. It's your lifestyle. You can't just come in here and you know, be sitting out there and then come in here and it worked for you. It's not going to work. Good point. Thank you.
The damage that false religion can cause, or a hypocrisy within the way we practice is a big deal. And one of the mistakes that people make when they identify the hypocrisy, okay, that's hypocrisy which falls into issue a person's attitude. So do they throw out the attitude?
Nope.
No. they throw out the religion.
Yeah.
Man, what are you thinking? What are you thinking?
They have not received the love of the truth. They've been tricked.
Yeah, I mean, they're looking for the excuse.
Yes.
To reject. Exactly.
Yep.
The reason to follow.
Right. So, in Isaiah chapter 29, verse 13, that is not the right... interesting. Wait a minute. I'm in the wrong... I'm sorry. It is the right one. I'm in the wrong chapter here. Then the Lord said, because his people draw near to me with their words and honor me with their lip service, but their hearts is removed far from me. You ever read that somewhere in the New Testament? The answer is yes, you do. Okay. So, how many years... When, roughly, give me a guess, when Isaiah was written? 700. I'm going to go with right before 720, because Assyria is yet coming. So we'll go with 725. Great. But this is quoted in Matthew, not talking about the people of 725 B.C., but the people of Jesus' day. And the point is, they are the same. They have not changed. Yes. This illustrates a couple things about God. What does this illustrate about God? 700 and, we'll say, 700 years of the same behavior, wrong behavior. What does this illustrate about anybody, but I'm thinking about God?
Patience.
Patience? Anything else? He remembers. Yeah, don't ever forget that. He remembers. What?
Mercy, grace.
Ah, that's the one I'm going for first. Well, no, the second one. Sorry. His reasonable justice. Reasonable. Was it just to condemn them for something they had been doing wrong for 700 years? Yes. Oh, that God. He's just so unreal. 700 years. And then God's unreasonable patience, or as George says, his stubborn patience. Is that my... Is it yours? Okay. Not a problem, guys. He's got to take a breath. Okay.
The first of those, you mean justness or justice?
Justness. He is just. Yeah. Either, but I was thinking it is an attribute. From 29 verses 9 through 12, which we read, blind yourselves and be blind. They become drunk not with wine, they stagger not with strong drink. For the Lord has poured over you a spirit of deep sleep. He has shut your eyes. The prophets, he has covered your heads, the seers. The entire vision will be to you like words of a sealed book, which they can't understand. Okay, here are the prophets and the seers, and he brings them the word of God, and they do not understand it. Unbelief had darkened spiritual perception. Okay, I have spiritual perception. There are spiritual truths out there, and I can perceive them. But my point is right now that their unbelief had hindered their ability to perceive spiritual truths.
It hardened their hearts.
Yes.
And for us, we can do that just as well.
How?
How? It's very, you know, it's very easy. When we want to do something what we want to do, and we're going to tell God, you know, I know what your word is, but this is what I'm going to do because... This is my life, and
right.
I can do it however I want.
And when we do what we want, when we do what we want...
There will be consequences.
Exactly. And here's the point. Use it or lose it. Use your faith. Use your submission to God. I will do what you want, or you will lose your ability to understand what sin is.
As soon as you say... I know what you want me to do, God, but
yeah,
it's not even a red flag. It's a big red light bulb should come on and wake you up. Hello.
That's right. Not a flag, a light bulb. I'm with you. The more you practice your faith, the more you know. Can you think of a passage that says that? The more you practice, the more you know. Hebrews 5. Every time. Hebrews 5. My favorite is, because I just like the way it's said, I'm not a poet, but some things that are poetic or metaphorical I like. Matthew 13. After telling them the parables, they don't understand it. And so he explains it to them. And he explains several to them. And then he says to them, do you get it now? And they say, yes, now we understand. And he says in verse 51, have you understood all these things? And they say to him, yes. And Jesus said to them, therefore, every scribe who has become a disciple of the kingdom of heaven is like the head of a house who brings out of his treasure things old and things new. And every time you read it, you say, wow, I didn't get that. I was excited last week when Rick was sitting back there. I consider Rick to be a much more accomplished teacher than I am, reasonably so. And he came home and he said, I heard some things that I had not considered before. And I said, that's good. This is what we do. We pour over it. We come back to it. Hebrews chapter 5. Now the flip side of this coin is, the more you practice your faith, the more you know. What's the other side? The polar opposite. You can't escape it. The less you practice, the less you know. Romans chapter 1. They stop giving thanks, and then boom! They're not only thinking homosexuality is okay, they're doing it themselves and encouraging others to do it also. And in fact, if the others didn't do it and give hearty approval, they didn't like them. Is it okay to act do homosexual acts? Oh, yes. That's what they would have said. Originally? No. They would have said, no, bad. But God gave them over. They wanted more. God gave them over. They wanted more. This is what happens. So, beware. There are people from among us who are now down here. It can happen. Right here at home. You know, we talk so much of abstracts and principles and other people. But the whole point is, watch out.
The reason we're bringing it up is because it can happen.
You're right. Yep, and nobody in here wants somebody else to die. Especially me. I don't want me to die. And you don't want you to die, and we don't want each other to die. And so we bring up these truths that are sometimes difficult and hard to talk about. Comment? Yes, George.
A little bit of application here when it comes to faith and knowledge, and then the section that we're looking at here. In Isaiah, the history of the Israelites and the concept that we're going to get into here, the section I studied in chapters 30 through 34, and trust in Egypt, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Don't trust Egypt. For the Pharisees, with all that history and all the knowledge they should have had that would have led to faith when Christ came, to stand there when Christ was on the cross and say, save yourself if you're the Son. Say, what a hypocritical thing. What a faithless, ignorant thing to say when you are the nation of God and have been told for 700 years, okay, that God will save you. You will not save yourself. How easily should they be able to identify with that perspective after having prophecy like this over and over again? Where was their knowledge? Because they had no faith, you know.
Where was their knowledge?
Well, I mean, they trusted themselves.
In their traditions?
Yeah.
And in the, you have heard those of old say. Okay, so here's the deal. You ever go to a Bible study? I might have talked about this probably 15 times too many, but I was down in Knoxville. We were at Panera Bread having a Bible study. I've mentioned this. Have I? We're having a Bible study. It's Rick, Lee, Matt Duggan, and a man that we're having a Bible study with. Now, they do this every Thursday, I think. Every Thursday right now, they do Panera Bread Meetup Bible Study. Do you know what books were open at our table? And I'm not trying to be prideful. What books were open at our table as we had a Bible study? The Bible. The group behind us was having a Bible study. Do you know what book they had open?
Okay.
Let me rephrase. Do you know what book they did not have open? The Bible. No, they had a book that talked about the Bible. and see Satan is so effective. All he's got to do is get you. You think you're talking about the Bible, but you're not. You're talking about a book that talks about the Bible. And that's what the Jews did. They when Jesus says, look, what did a Jew say? A Jew said, well, I don't know, old Rabbi so-and-so said this, and old Rabbi so-and-so said this, and they didn't get into the Torah themselves, right?
Well, I had a conversation today with somebody who had a very drastic opinion on something that was in the Bible that I'd never heard before. I was like, how did you even come up with that? And he said, I read this book that explained about the Bible. He said, you know what? I'd rather listen to the source. I'd rather listen to God's writing rather than the man who may not know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, chapter 25, verse 15. Woe to those who deeply hide their plans from the Lord. Here's a third woe against those who do things in secret. Woe to those who deeply hide their plans from the Lord, and those whose deeds are done in dark places. And they say, who sees us or who knows us? Number one, folks, God always knows. Don't worry about that. It's in secret. Okay, God always knows what just happened. Oh man, what did I do? I went back to the... Wow. Don't worry, it's not a problem. I can fix this real fast. Where am I? What am I doing? Look at that. Okay. All right, so remember this. What did we say? That God always knows. Here, God always knows what's going on. David, did he try to do something in secret? The end of it says, but the thing David had done was evil in the sight of the Lord. Those are the last words of that chapter. Oh, he tried. Nobody else knew. Well, some guy knew a little bit. God knew it all. Matthew 6, 4, 6, and 18. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you in secret. This passage, 1 Timothy 5, the context is about elders who have done wrong and how to interact with them. Timothy, you're a young man. Here comes this elder. Well, verse 24, the sins of some men are quite evident, going before them to judgment. Yeah, some people you see sin. But you know, some people are pretty good at hiding it from men. For others, their sins follow after them. We won't know. I could be doing something that not a single person in here knows about. But you know who does know? I read some commentary. What is stupid people then to act wickedly and think their maker doesn't see it? What a stupid people then to ignore him? Harsh word, but true. They make their plans in secret. Oh really? You really are stupid if you actually think you can do that. You, verse 15, turn things around. Shall the potter be considered as equal with the clay? That what is made would say to its maker, he did not make me, or what is formed, say to him who formed it, he has no understanding of it. And what we're talking about here is pride. To say that he cannot see, he can't see me, is to make him like us. Because we can't see each other. God can. And when I say, oh, he can't see me, it's to make him like us. Or to make us higher, at least as equal, if not higher, than he is. And the root cause of this is pride. Now, where is this passage quoted in the New Testament? Do you remember? Romans chapter 9. The context is, look, it's by a promise, it's by a promise. And God hardens whom he will harden, has mercy on whom he has mercy. And they say, well, then who, it's not fair, is essentially what they're saying. And Paul says to them, he quotes, or he actually refers to it, he doesn't actually quote it, depends on who you're referring to, what commentary. chapter 9, and he says, "You will say to me then, why does he still find fault for who resists his will?" In other words, look, if God's doing it, then I have no control over it. On the contrary, who are you, O man, who answers back to his God? The thing molded will not say to the molder, "Why did you make me like this?" will it? Or does the potter, not the potter, have the right over the clay to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use? So he's saying to them, look, and he refers back to this passage in Isaiah, and he says, don't you question God. God's plan is God's plan. So just like they have no ground to make plans apart from God, they have no ground to question the plans that God himself has made. All of it has to do with pridefulness, and the point is, be humble. Be humble. I'm only a man. As the movie The Gladiator said, dust and bone, dust and ashes? Ashes and dust. I think it's ashes and dust. Keep on forgetting it. Look, we're here for a little time. We're dirt. God made us, and then we're going to go away. And we would talk to God and say, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. 17 through 19, the future is inevitable. On that day, the deaf will hear. Verse 18, on that day, the deaf will hear the words of a book, and out of their gloom and out of their darkness, the eyes of the blind will see. So now he's saying, look, it's going to be opposite the situation you have now. Okay? Right now you have a situation where I'm sending you the word, but you're not receiving it, you don't want it, and you can't understand it. In a future time, it's going to be as though you've been blind. You've seen those YouTube shows where the colorblind person can see for the first time, or the person who is blind can see for the first time, sees his mommy for the first time, or the person who's been deaf talks or hears his mommy's voice for the first time, and their face is in shock. And the mom and dad are crying. This is what it's like. Look, for some people, there will be a time when this word will mean so much to them, when they wrap their arms around it, they will never let it go. Again, Matthew 13. Verse 22, talking about the future judgment of the unjust. Verse 22, therefore, thus says the Lord who redeemed Abraham concerning the house of Jacob, Jacob shall not now be ashamed, nor shall his face now turn pale. But when he sees his children, the work of my hands in his midst, they will sanctify my name. Indeed, they will sanctify the Holy One of Jacob and will stand in the awe of God of Israel. So again, time after time we have this picture. Judgment is coming. It's going to be hard. But for those who are faithful, it will be worth it. And when you see the product of this judgment, you will give God glory and you'll say, praise God for the work he has done. Comments or questions on this? Let's see if we can zip through chapters 30 and 31, because I intend to read some of it. Chapter 30 and 31, and 32, but only 30 and 31 for now. The fourth and fifth woes are against alliances. George was mentioning this earlier. Remember from chapter 20, Assyria is coming. It's the year that Assyria took Ashdod, and God says, don't go down to Egypt, because Egypt is going to be taken with hooks in their noses to Assyria. They're not going to do anything. Assyria is coming, and Egypt won't do you any good. They already know that. That's the context. Chapter 30, verse 1. Woe to the rebellious children, declares the Lord, who execute a plan, but not mine, and make an alliance, but not by my spirit, in order to add sin to sin, who proceed down to Egypt without consulting me, to take refuge in the safety of Pharaoh. Verse 3, the shame of such behavior. Therefore, the safety of Pharaoh will be your shame, and the shelter of the shadow of Egypt will be your humiliation. For the princes of Zoan, for their princes are at Zoan, and their ambassadors arrive at hand. Okay, you've got all the princes coming together and counseling each other. Why are they doing that? Because they're being attacked. What do we do? They're down there in Egypt asking the same question. What do we do? And he says, don't you go to Egypt. They're wondering the same thing you are. Verse 5, everyone will be ashamed of it. Verse 6, this is talking about, okay, what's going to happen in Egypt? The oracle concerning the beasts of the Negev, which means the south. through the land of distress and anguish. Verse 7, Rahab, which means arrogant, who has been exterminated. This land down there that you're putting your trust in, they're going to be gone. Nuclear bomb is going to hit them. Nuclear. Verse 8, go and write it on a tablet before them, inscribe it on a scroll, that it may serve in the time to come as a witness forever. For this is a rebellious people of false sons, sons who refuse to listen to the instruction of the Lord, who say to the seers, you must not see visions. He's saying, look, Egypt isn't going to last. And you guys aren't going to last easier because you refuse to listen to me. I tell you over and over again, and you refuse to listen to me. Verse 12, therefore, says the Holy One of Israel, since you have rejected this word and have put your trust in oppression and guile and relied on them, I'm going to come and I'm going to judge you. Verses 18, God's true desire for them, I should have marked this. Therefore, the Lord longs to be gracious to you. Look, God doesn't want to do this to you. But because you refuse to listen to him, he's going to bring judgment. I'm going to go very quickly through here. Verse 27, the name of the Lord comes from a remote place, burning in his anger and dense in his smoke. His lips are filled with indignation. His tongue is like a consuming fire. His breath is an overflowing torrent, which reaches to the neck and shakes the nations back and forth in a sieve, and put in the jaws of the peoples the bridles which leads to ruin. You will have songs as in the night when you keep the festival, the gladness of your hearts when one marches to the sound of the flute, to go to the mountain of the Lord, the rock of Israel. And the Lord will cause his voice of authority to be heard, and the descending of his arm will be seen in fierce anger, and in the flame of the consuming fire, in cloudburst, downpour, and hailstones. For at the sound of the Lord, Assyria will be terrified. Okay, Assyria's coming. He says, don't go down to Egypt because they're going to be beat up. Now he says, guess what? Assyria itself is going to be beat up. You don't even have to go to Egypt because Assyria is going to be destroyed. Verse 31. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help, who rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they do not look to the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Lord. Yet he also is wise and will bring disaster, and does not retract his words, but will arise against the house of the evildoers and against the help of the iniquity of the workers of iniquity. Now, the Egyptians are men and not God, and their horses are flesh and not spirit. So the Lord will stretch out his hand, and he who helps will stumble, and he who is helped will fall, and all of them will come to an end together. If you go down to Egypt, he's going to be destroyed. He will be destroyed, and everybody he's helping will be destroyed. Verse 4, okay, what is going to save Israel? Verse 4, thus says the Lord to me, as in Isaiah, as a lion or the young lion growls over his prey, which is against which a band of shepherds is called out, and he will not be terrified at their voice, nor disturbed as at their noise. So will the Lord of hosts come down to wage war on Mount Zion and on its hill like flying birds. So the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem. He will protect it and deliver it. He will pass over and he will rescue it. Verse 8, the Assyrian will fall by the sword, not of man, and a sword not of man will devour him. Okay, Assyria is coming. Let's run down to Egypt. And he says, no, don't go down to Egypt. They're not going to save you. And then he says Assyria itself will be destroyed. Really, who's going to save Israel? I will, he says. And he pictures himself as an animal over his prey. And his prey, actually in this case, is Israel, who he's protecting. And he says, come on, Assyria, bring it on. I, God, will protect Israel. Now, that's 31, chapters 30 and 31. In 2 Kings chapter 19. Do you remember Rabshakeh who's calling up onto the wall? He's saying, don't trust in Jehovah. Don't let Hezekiah trick you into trusting in Jehovah. And then he runs down to Egypt real quick, Rabshakeh does. And Hezekiah brings the letter and brings it to the temple of the Lord and he prays. Do you remember that? He prays. In fact, let's turn there, 2 Kings 19. Verse 14, Hezekiah took the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it, and he went up to the house of the Lord, and he spread it out before the Lord, and Hezekiah prayed. Verse 20, Isaiah, the son of Amos, sent to Hezekiah saying, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me about Sennacherib, the king of Israel, I have heard you." Verse 32, "Therefore thus says the Lord concerning the king of Assyria, he will not come out to this day." Verse 35, "Then it happened that night that the angel of the Lord went out and struck 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men rose early in the morning, behold, all of them were dead. So Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, departed and returned home and lived at Nineveh. And then he died. He was killed by his own sons." Quick review. Don't go down to Egypt. They won't help you. Don't worry about Assyria. They're going to be destroyed too. Trust in me. I will save you. Fulfillment? 2 Kings chapter 19. An angel of the Lord goes out and kills 185,000 of them. Assyria. The threat that was not actually a threat. Assyria's coming. God says, don't worry about them. They're not even going to last. They will never become a threat to you. Have you ever thought you had a threat that turned out not to be a threat? Yeah. The point over and over again is how foolish we are. The solution that was not a solution. When you had this threat that turned out not to be a threat at all, did you choose a solution that was not a solution? I have. I've actually had real threats where I've chosen a solution that was not the solution. Egypt wasn't a solution. But did they know this? They didn't know it. But who did? God knew it. And God told them. So what was the issue? They weren't listening. Simple, trusting faith in God. God said this is going to happen. God said do this. I'll do it. God said it will happen. Then I know it will happen. God said do this. This is what I'll do. I mean, I'm right up here with the best of you. I can fumble this as many times as all of you can. This lesson is for me as much as it is for anybody else. What they did, they tried to think too much. What they did not do, they did not trust God. Woe to you who go down to Egypt, who trust in this and trust in that, but they do not look to the Holy One of Israel. Here's what they did. They tried to think, oh, Assyria's coming, and I know the future, so I don't have to trust in God. I do it all the time. Israel, the people who were not of God. In fact, that's what he says in chapter 30, verse 9. This is a rebellious people, false sons. If you walked up to them and said, hey, are you a son of God? They would have said, yes. Were they? No. Can it happen? Yes, it can, and I can be the one. Go ahead, Brian.
What I was going to say is that too many times it seems like when we need to turn and speak to God and listen to God, we have everybody else talking, and the one that we're listening to the most is everybody else, and we get humbled when God says in His own manner and way, see, I've told you so, but you didn't listen to me. And, you know, we have to, in our lives, we have to remember who is in control. Mm-hmm. It's not us. It's not the things of this world. It is the Creator and the Sustainer who has created and done this. He has provided us His Word, His knowledge, His encouragement. But until we get off our pride and off our pity pots, we're not going to realize it until it's over. And then we're like, you know, Father, you were always right.
Like Nebuchadnezzar. I built this, and then boom, he's done. George, you guys driving tonight? Because more you talk, the longer.
I'll try to be quick.
Yeah.
So Israel went from
being in a good situation in terms of taking the land, and now many, many, many years later, there's no faith anymore. There's no recognition of what God's power can accomplish. There's none of that. And it reminds me of how important Deuteronomy 6, write these things on your forehead. Was that going on generation to generation? If it had been, if a father was teaching his son these things as it had admonished them to do so in the law, would they be returning to Egypt for
right.
their help, who they were escaping to begin with, and who they, I mean, God's saying, look at this Egypt, guys. You saw what I did to Egypt for your benefit.
Yeah.
And so here they're in a situation where they think they're choosing, and this is where I'm kind of trying to hint at some application, the lesser of what they seem to think is two evils. Okay? But they have given up all of the heritage that God gave them and understanding what was going on here, and so they're seeking help from somebody they would never, ever seek help from. You get help from somebody they would never, ever, ever, ever. You know, it just...
Yeah. Good point. I'm going to... Okay, let me go on because we're here, okay? Because we're in this area. Have you ever heard of making an alliance that's not of God? That's what they did. They made an alliance with not of God. 2 Corinthians 6, you remember the passage? It says, what fellowship does light have with darkness? So on and so forth. Over and over. This is not something that we can't do anymore. Oh, well, we're not a literal nation, so we can't make a literal alliance with the United States or Russia or China or Belize or whoever you want to say. No, we're not. But we can make alliances with people that God says, don't do it. The same thing can happen. What about executing a plan, but not of God? I have this. I need to accomplish a task. It is a God-given task, probably. It is a God-given task. I will execute a plan. The question is it God's plan? Take a man or a woman, not of God's people. Is that in God's plan? He says, don't do it! Right? Take a job that inherently involves sin or inhibits growth, but it's a job. Something other than biblical approach to discipline? I know, it's got to be done, but I'm going to do it my way. No, do it God's way. Here's one. Something other than the work and worship of the New Testament pattern. Here's the pattern, here's the plan. Oh, I think I'll just go and make my own. What does it say? I'm going to execute a plan. No. We need to do God's plan, right? And then maybe there's a lot of other applications. George Bosworth, will you pray for us, please? Can you? Are you able to? Yeah.